supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. My friend Claudia told me about a colleague of hers whose husband walked out of the marriage after 20 years. She said it came out of nowhere. Well, of course, with marriage, that's rarely the case, but I began thinking about that phrase, out of nowhere. 33 years ago, a tire hit my car, and that tire came out of nowhere, and in moments, I was a quadriplegic. Or what else comes out of nowhere? A lump in the breast, out of nowhere. On the other hand, when we fall in love, that comes out of nowhere too. So we, silly humans, we really think we can predict the future. We know what's going to happen tomorrow. It gives us the illusion of security. Well, on today's show, we're going to talk about how life comes at us, what we do with those out-of-nowhere moments. Our guests say our responses have a lot to do with how resilient we are and how much self-compassion we have. I'm joined on the phone by psychologist Leslie Becker Phelps and B. Hollander Goldfein. Leslie Becker Phelps is a clinician. She's on the medical staff at Somerset Medical Center in New Jersey. She blogs for Psychology Today and WebMD, and she's the expert on WebMD's Relationships and Coping Community Forum, and she joins us by phone. Leslie, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
B. Hollander Goldfein is a staff psychologist at the Council for Relationships. She's director of the research project Transcending Trauma, which focuses on families of Holocaust survivors, and she had a hand in writing a very important book called Transcending Trauma, Survival, Resilience, and Clinical Implications for Survivor Families. Bea, welcome back.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
And in a little while, we're going to hear a local woman's incredible story of transcending trauma. But we'd like to hear from you. I am confident everybody listening has had an out-of-nowhere experience. Most of you, they have been life-altering. I would love to hear from you today and tell us what happened to you in the wake of that, short-term, long-term. Our number, 888-477-9499. Again, 888-477-9499. Leslie, let's start with you. Because the human mind is the way it is, we believe, for better or worse, like I said, that tomorrow is predictable. And, you know, whether we experience a major event or not, that's rarely the case. It's amazing that we still think that way, despite all the contrary evidence. We still think we know what's going to happen tomorrow.
Absolutely.
What is it? What is it about the human mind brain that just doesn't integrate all this information?
You know, it goes back, honestly, to that survival instinct. You know, we have to get to know who we are, who the world is, who people are around us, so that we can survive, we can get through. And as we accumulate that experience, we then, you know, can predict what will happen next so we can respond best. So we develop a certain bias. We continue to use the bias, and we start to think that that is the way the world is, as opposed to our judgments about it.
Yeah, we there's so much distorted thinking, even in our worldview, even in our identities. You know, there's some research out now that shows that we think our identities are our identities. And,
right.
You know, we're going to talk later in the show about how identities change, especially with these out-of-nowhere experiences. B, let's turn to you. When we have one of these out-of-nowhere experiences, we are usually deeply troubled and shocked. Some people say, why me? And live with pity or resentment. And others find a way to live the lives they have. And what's the difference? Before you answer that, I was thinking about that. It's not black or white. You know, you're not either living with resentment or you're a resilient person. I mean, there's an awful lot of gray in there, too, yes?
Well, there's a lot of ways in which human beings function and the way we interact with the world. There are thoughts, our belief systems, our feelings, our deep, visceral experience of the world, and they're the things that we do. And then there are the relationships in our lives, both close in terms of family and loved ones, friendships, work relationships, and others. And we function on a physical level and an emotional level and, you know, a brain level. You know, so all of these are different aspects of the human experience. And depending on the nature of the out-of-nowhere experience, we will have different responses to those events based on what's impacted in our lives.
Example.
Let's take divorce, okay? An out-of-nowhere divorce. Yeah, you know, you think you're
okay. You take divorce.
Okay. Well, we can leave it to somebody else. But let's look at divorce. And for the person where it's an out-of-nowhere experience who didn't see it coming, they're totally unprepared. Of course, they're shocked. There's the emotional level of loss, fear of future, fear of what's going to happen to young children or older children. Everything is thrown up into the air. You know, your life has been turned upside down, and there's the raw pain of that. Okay. So when in coping with that, we cope on many levels. Eventually, once the shock wears off and the person has to take one step at a time through day-to-day life, okay, their sort of basic coping and adaptive mechanisms kick in. Okay. Now, if those mechanisms are positive ones, if life and family relationships and development has given someone positive capacities, okay, positive adaptation, what we call resilience, okay, then they can bring forth those capacities. But if the person, for some reason, has had a difficult life, difficult upbringing, difficult relationships, and for them in their adulthood, their resources to handle things are somewhat challenged or limited because of prior experience, then their coping with it would be different. But I just want to contrast that, okay, to an experience that is not only difficult but also life-threatening. Because once the out-of-nowhere experience, and in this case we're talking about the negatives, the traumatic, becomes life-threatening, then there's a whole level of response that's physical, that's physiological, that's based on how the brain processes trauma. And then the sense of threat, anxiety, what could happen to me, responding to a near-death experience puts a whole other dimension on the coping with something that's really challenging.
Well, speaking of that kind of experience, we've got one of our callers is Bernard, who had a liver transplant. Let's hear Bernard's story. Hi, Bernard.
Hi, Ben. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Yes, I was in the University of Pennsylvania a year ago today. And I had been admitted with end-stage liver disease. The problem was that the doctors, my hepatologist has told me that there were no livers available because of the competition in the Northeast being so incredibly high. The best they could do was try and fat me up and send me back home to wait. However, the subtext read that I would probably be dead by mid-year. Out of the blue, out of nowhere, on January 21st, the day before I was transferred to a long-term acute nursing facility, I received a phone call at 2:30 in the morning from the National Liver Institute telling me that there had unexpectedly become a liver. A liver had become available. A four-year-old female had died in an accident, and it would fit my small frame. Was I interested? Of course, I took it, and I'm here speaking to you today. And feel that I have to live for myself, but also for the spirit of that child. I'm blessed, and I thank you for being there, because I've listened to you guys for years.
Thank you.
I guess that's all I have.
Well, maybe not. I'm not. You might be done with me, but I'm not done with you, Bernard.
Go ahead, Dan.
So I, you know, you talk about that phone call being an out of nowhere experience, but I want to talk about this liver, your previous liver, the fact that you knew you were dying.
Correct.
Was that an out of nowhere experience?
Repeat the question.
What about your life back then, your identity back then? Did that come out of nowhere, the realization that you might die soon?
It dawned on me from, I'd say, maybe June or July of 2011. I realized that this is it, you know. Life is cause and effect. You live and you do things and you regret them, but you can't change the course of events. You know, I've been in service to people through social services. I do music therapy for addicts and alcoholics for many years now, and I just felt that there's some things that can't be affected. And on more than one occasion, people have told me after transplant, they said, you know, God's not done with you, buddy. You got work to do here. So I'm back to work. I'm working, you know, three times a week doing music therapy again, and I'm grateful.
Yeah, you sound very grateful. Well, I have a feeling that you and I are not the only ones that are grateful for you and for your out-of-nowhere experience.
That's a kind thing to say.
Thank you so much for your call, Bernard.
Thank you, Dan, and thank you to your guests. Have a peaceful day.
You too. Leslie, one of the things I was wondering about with Bernard was the whole issue of identity that, you know, I alluded to earlier. You know, we have this identity that we are whatever. We're a worker, a regular guy, a husband, whatever. And then identity changes. You know, when we have this kind of traumatic experience, you know, before my accident, my identity was a father, a husband, a psychologist, and all of that went away in a moment. And for the next 2, 3, 5, maybe 10 years, my identity was simply, I am a quadriplegic. So, you know, identity changes, but it's always painful, always frightening.
Yeah. A couple of things come to my mind. One thing is that what struck me with Bernard is how grateful he was.
Yeah.
And his positive take on it. You know, there's always struggles. Nobody just comes through these things without pain and struggle. But what was prominent for him, and I don't know if he, you know, started this way, but is the gratefulness. You know, other people, because of their identity and how they go into these things, come out bitter and resentful, as opposed to finding that resilience, finding the way through and you know, a positive way to approach it. And as B suggested, you know, a lot of that has to do with, you know, your earlier development, what your experiences were and, you know, who you were born into this world as, in helping you, in defining who you are at that moment when those out of nowhere experiences happen.
Viktor Frankl said that the people who survive are people who, while they are in crisis, can create a vision of themselves doing something else meaningful later on in their lives. And we certainly see that with Bernard. Well, back to Frankl, as a Holocaust survivor, he certainly knew something about surviving crisis, but do you think it comes down to that, a future vision of being able to do something meaningful?
Right. I don't think anything comes down to that, to just one thing. And Viktor Frankl describes that while in the concentration camp, he was able to hold on to the meaning of finding his wife. Certainly many survivors held on to that as well. But I think the real challenge for many was really after. You know, how do you take your first steps after liberation? A piece of it, and certainly survivors talk about this, is finding meaning in a world that has been shattered in terms of all assumptions of humanity. And for many survivors, that meaning did come from rebuilding their family. But it also came from the quality of the relationships with their family, the roles and responsibilities they had for other, fulfilling the legacies of the past, the families that were lost and still that were held inside that they wanted to live and fulfill.
We heard that from Bernard, too, that he wanted to honor that little girl who gave him her liver.
That's right.
we're going to have to take a short break. When we do, we're going to be hearing a local woman's incredible story of transcending trauma. That's what we're talking about today. We're talking about how life comes at us often out of nowhere and changes our lives, changes our identity, changes everything. Give us a call, 888-477-9499. We'd like to hear from you about your out-of-nowhere experiences, what it did to your identity, and what it did in the aftermath of this out-of-nowhere experience. Again, 888-477-9499. I'm talking with Leslie Becker Phelps. She's a psychologist, and she blogs for Psychology Today and WebMD. Bea Hollander-Goldfein is local. She's at the Council for Relationships and had a hand in writing the book Transcending Trauma, Survival, Resilience, and Clinical Implications in Survivor Families. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
University of the Sciences in Philadelphia supports WHYY. Careers in healthcare and the sciences continue to be strong. University of the Sciences has been preparing graduates for almost 200 years with hands-on learning, respected faculty, and a student life experience. Offering pre-med, occupational or physical therapy, pharmacy, or any other of 25 undergraduate, 20 master's, and PhD programs where healthcare and science converge. More online at usciences.edu. Supporting WHYY, the Garrett and Tatiana Copeland Arrhythmia Center at ChristianaCare offers care for people who experience irregular heartbeat, also known as arrhythmia. For those with a racing heart or one that beats too slowly, who have had problems with their heartbeat or have fainted, an arrhythmia assessment may be needed. ChristianaCare encourages people with these symptoms to talk to a doctor. For more information or to make an appointment, 800-693-CARE or ChristianaCare.org/arrhythmia.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about out-of-nowhere experiences, how kind of life unfolds for us, for good and for bad. For bad, we label it trauma. For good, we label it, I don't know, we don't pay much attention to those. But my guests are psychologists Leslie Becker Phelps and Bea Hollander-Goldfein. Leslie.
Yes.
Everyone knows the saying, I don't know if I can say this on public radio, let's say poopy happens. So, God, that was uncomfortable. Anyway, you know, it's kind of a resentful way of looking at the truth of our lives, at these out-of-nowhere experiences, but there's this kind of resentful, angry tone. I prefer to say Shiva happens, which is the Jewish mourning period following a death, because after all, when we have these experiences, it changes us, and all change is loss, and all loss is like a death. Do you feel that there's a mourning process?
Absolutely. I think that's a beautiful way of putting it. Shiva happens. I like it. I may adopt it if you don't mind.
Yeah, I'm thinking of getting a bumper sticker.
All change is loss. And sometimes I think people, when you're going through something, it's hard to see that with the loss is also an opportunity for a gain. Even at the end of it, you didn't necessarily still want that loss to happen, but to be able to let go through that process, let go of what your old self-perceptions were, perceptions of the world were, and to grab onto something meaningful and positive moving forward. I mean, that's really the transition, the trick of it.
Well, I quote a Sufi way too often on this show, but I'll do it again. And he said, when the heart weeps for what it's lost, the soul rejoices for what it's found. And it really does have to be in that order.
There are also things that come out of nowhere when we're going through a process. And I've seen that happen a lot with people. So I guess this keeps coming to my mind as we're talking on here is I used to run a program for women with histories of severe physical, sexual, emotional abuse. And clearly, it affected them in some very negative ways as adults, and that's why they were in the program. And there was one woman who felt she had nothing to live for, was always on the verge of feeling suicidal, just couldn't find meaning. And one point, she needed to take a trip. She went on an airplane, was up in the airplane, and the airplane hit some pretty severe turbulence. And during that turbulence, she held on for dear life, and she found herself saying, "Please, God, don't let me die." It was at that moment, that out-of-nowhere experience, kind of, that she found, it helped her find a different meaning. It became a positive thing in her life, certainly did not resolve all the issues. But sometimes these out-of-nowhere experiences, really move us, jolt us.
Yeah, she realized she didn't want to die.
Yeah, something she didn't know before.
Yeah, yeah. B, there's lots of factors that come into play here, and you've talked about them. One's personality, family relationships, belief systems. Right. Even their genetics, their history. This is contrary to what many pop psychologists seem to imply when they say, all you have to do is, or three steps to. Many of the factors around coping really are out of our control.
Right. I mean, I think the popular psych versions is when you already have it mostly together and you just need a little swift kick to pull it off, that's when it can be helpful. But for people who struggle on deeper levels, that's not going to really help them. They have to work hard. They have to work towards self-awareness, which is very important. You have to work towards the awareness of other people.
Awareness of other people?
You have to bring your self-awareness, understanding how you react, how you think, how you feel in response to life experiences to someone else, to know that if they've gone through this particular experience, they're probably feeling so. If I speak to them in this way, I'm going to impact them. That's a very important part of the grounding of resilience.
You're talking about vulnerability tolerance.
being aware of your feelings, being able to handle your feelings in various situations, being socially connected.
Well, speaking of handling feelings in certain situations, let's bring on Aviva Perlow. Aviva Perlow is a social worker living in Mount Airy. She writes about coping with adversity. She wrote us a letter a few weeks ago that inspired this very show. Aviva, hi. Welcome to Voices.
Hi. Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
Sure. Aviva, I was, well, doesn't matter how I reacted. You've got quite a story that illustrates this phenomenon. Tell us what happened to you 20 years ago.
20 years ago, I was hit by a stray bullet. I was sitting in a restaurant with my sister and some friends, and I suddenly fell over and couldn't breathe, and nobody knew why. And there was some searching. The pain was so intense that I imagined a bowling ball had been dropped from a rooftop on my back. And so I tried to direct a few friends to look for a bowling ball. And as it turned out, a stray bullet had come from 5 to 7 miles away, an illegal, at that time, assault rifle, AK-47, and pierced my lung, my spleen, my diaphragm, and lodged in my stomach. And I had emergency surgery to have the bullet removed. And I remember going into surgery and asking, is it serious? And I remember one of the techs in the operating room sort of patting me on the, you know, it'll be okay, honey. And another one said, we don't know, we'll have to see, you know, count to 10 and by 6 you'll be out. And I knew from that I extrapolated it was a 50-50 if I would wake up again. And I was 18 at the time. I was attending Emory. It was considered a good school. I was playing soccer there and volunteering with the elderly and involved with Hillel and Jewish Life. And that was the farthest thing. Guns were the farthest thing from my world.
So, Aviva, obviously you survived the surgery, but tell us what happened to you psychologically in the immediate aftermath.
Yes. Immediately, it was, as B mentioned, the life-threatening physical, the surgeries, the recuperations. It took a year before I was able to physically exercise again after being a competitive athlete, and eating and bathroom and daily functioning and digestion all were altered. And that was very hard to deal with, and that's where a lot of the energy went immediately. And after, thank God, that was secured, then I had more space over the years to start asking, you know, why me? Why do bad things happen? What does this mean? What's going on? And it was very important for me to reach out to friends, mentors, teachers, rabbis, therapists, doctors, and create, you know, they say diversify your portfolio. And for me, I needed to do that for coping and have a lot of a broad support system. In particular, I wanted older people, like 20, 40 years older, that I could speak with who were familiar with death and loss, because I was 18 and beer and boys was popular at 18, not, you know, death and shooting.
So there's something about you that you knew what you needed at the time. Let me turn to my guest, B. Leslie. Mm-hmm. Is that unusual to know that what we need to help heal, like in the aftermath of crisis?
I think it is wonderful when people know what they need, because that's, you know, that's an important step. And if you don't know, then your step is to have to figure it out. You know, you're a step ahead when you know. And really, I think a lot of, you know, what really anybody's going through or looking for with an out-of-nowhere experience like this is eventually have to get to is a place of acceptance. Not necessarily being happy about it, but kind of, okay, this is where I am. This is where life has put me, and what do I do with it?
Are you familiar, B, before we go back to Aviva, with any research about, is it common for people to be as almost wise? I mean, that's Viva's quality of wisdom there. I mean, is
I'm not aware of research on that, but I would say it's very mixed. So as a clinician doing therapy with people and as a human in the world, I think there are those who have a sense of compassion for themselves. They need to know they're going through something, and they give themselves the time to do it, and they take it step by step, and they seek help. Other people are bewildered, and they're shocked, and they think they can just get up and live their life, or they just want to lie down and give up living it. So they need the counsel of friends, they need the advice of professionals, and they need to ultimately accept their suffering and then take the steps to handle it.
Mm. One thing that I can add, Dan, is that people with a strong background, and I'm going to guess Aviva probably had a strong background, and, you know, supportive background, positives, so that she developed a sense of a secure attachment in herself, in the world. And we do know about 60% of people are securely attached. And people who have that tend to be more resilient, more positive, can reflect upon their feelings and their thoughts and what's going on, and would be more likely to respond as she did. And yet I still think at 18 years old that is pretty incredible, pretty wonderful that she could do that.
Aviva, we were talking about identity issues at the time. Mm-hmm. You said you were 18. You must have been a freshman in college. Did you have a sense of what you wanted to do with your life before the accident?
Different thoughts, you know, anything from in second grade, you know, being the first female president to being an attorney. But I just have to clarify something for the record. I did not know what I was doing. It feels, in retrospect, I'm 20 years down the road, so I have that affordability to look back and say, here's what happened. In the moment, it felt very much like walking through a dark tunnel, and your eyes are sort of blindfolded, and you just have to keep taking one step in front of the other, even though you don't know the map, you don't know the new terrain. My sense of security, comfort, worldview, you know, punishment, reward, all of that became turned upside its head and examined. And all I knew is that I needed help, and I could have an instinctive sense if someone was going to be compassionate and listening and understand, or if it was going to be maybe too heavy or not the right. There's some distinguishing of how will this ear be when I approach a person. And I've been lucky to have great teachers. I'm a student of bees, and I
well, let's hear about that. You worked with bee.
Transcending trauma project.
Yeah, let me ask you a question just between you and me. Is she any good?
B is one of the finest human beings that there is. Aside from her clinical work and her being a co-author of that book, which is amazing. It started in undergrad, and I had a fabulous teacher there too. I had to write. I had to write to try to make sense of what was happening. I had to, you know, walk in nature. I had to, there were things that just started happening. I wouldn't think about this is what I should do. But I had to learn to give myself permission to give space to those things. So I integrated it into my undergrad thesis, my master's thesis about human suffering, because I had to know more. I was, like, hungry. And the truth is, some of it still remains a mystery, and I'll never have answers, but at least I feel that I saw more of the lay of the land of, oh, there's something called trauma studies. Oh, there's people around the world that's looking at just at genocide or just at abuse or bullying. And it somehow, I guess I'm glad to know that that exists. I didn't know that it was like a field.
I wonder if you are like every other human who's endured trauma. I wonder if you felt very alone in the world.
There's definitely the highs and lows, yeah. And feeling isolated, that no one can relate, and then finding compassionate moments. And it waxes and wanes. And I guess that is just part of how it is.
Yeah.
And I'm also fortunate to have, you know, really wonderful people and friends and in my life. Unfortunately, with the guns, with Connecticut, with the rise of guns, now it's not an isolated experience anymore. It's actually quite frequent.
Yes, I know. Well, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to join us, and I am so happy with what you've learned and what in turn what you have to teach. So I appreciate your hanging out with us these last few moments. That was Aviva Perlow, a social worker living in Mount Airy, who writes about coping with adversity. Listen, before we take our break, I promise all of the callers who are on hold, we don't get to all of you, but we will get to the calls right after our break. We're talking about these out-of-nowhere experiences with Leslie Becker Phelps and B. Hollander Goldfein. Leslie is a psychologist, blogs for Psychology Today and WebMD. B. is a psychologist here at the Council for Relationships and director of the research project called Transcending Trauma. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Devereaux supports WHYY, a national behavioral healthcare organization founded and headquartered in Philadelphia. Devereaux is celebrating its 100th anniversary of providing innovative care for individuals with behavioral challenges, mental health illness, and developmental disabilities. Founded in 1912 by Philadelphia schoolteacher Helena Devereaux, the organization was developed to provide help to children and adults with special needs. Find more information about Devereaux and its centennial anniversary at 610-542-3041 or online at devereaux.org.
The Penn Memory Center at Penn Medicine supports WHYY and presents Cognitive Fitness, a comprehensive 12-week brain fitness program for adults with memory problems or concerns. Classes meet Tuesdays and Thursdays starting January 22nd and are offered in two locations, the University of Pennsylvania or in Gladwin, Pennsylvania. More information can be found at pennadc.org or 215-614-1828.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about these out-of-nowhere experiences that almost all of us have experienced. We're talking with psychologist Leslie Becker Phelps and B. Hollander Goldfein. B., one of the perks of being live in the studio is you can whisper to me during the breaks. You said you wanted to comment about something?
Right. I just wanted to comment that it's so easy in these kinds of conversations to focus on the individual. The individual has a horrific experience or an extremely positive one. And it's as if the person's life begins at the moment of this event. Okay. And it's so easy to forget that there's a life before, a person before this horrible thing happened, and that explains a lot about coping and adaptation and resilience. But I just want to point out also that for those individuals who had hardships in their life earlier, and those issues are not resolved, and the person has denied them somehow throughout their development, very often a current experience will re-trigger a response to that. So it looks like they're responding to the current adversity or trauma. And what is hidden is that there is pain that's coming from life before that also needs attention. I think this is very important in terms of the vets coming back and dealing with their experience in war and attempting to help them, that the help needs to be broader than the war and forward, that the help needs to look at the whole person and what they're dealing with.
That's one thing that concerns me about these very targeted, symptomatic, targeted treatments for PTSD and others. I promised our callers we would go to the phone, so let's start with Matthew. Hi, Matthew.
Hi, Dan. How are you?
Good. How about you?
Oh, wonderful today. I'd like to thank you and your guest today for having me on.
Sure. What can we do?
On October 4th, 2012, I had the great joy of accepting a new position after coming off the 6 months unemployment. And then on October 5th in the evening, I lost everything in a fire.
Everything?
Everything. Pretty much everything from my... everything in the apartment. I was away camping, so whatever I had with me, which is basically a few changes of clothes and the camping equipment, that was all that was left. And that was, to me, exactly what the show's about out of nowhere moments.
What happened to you, Matthew? You just said the facts. What happened to you?
I mean, it's still happening. I guess that's the easiest way to explain it is that, you know, it's a torn moment where, you know, it's, you're saying to yourself that it's just stuff, you know, it's just materials, but then there's a lot of emotion attached to the things that you've collected over many, many years, you know.
Do you feel like you are mourning?
There are moments when I feel that, you know, it'll come out of nowhere, you know, again, the theme of the show.
It all does.
Especially with the holidays. The holidays were a challenging time.
So let me ask you a couple of questions that I've learned to ask from my guest experts today. What kind of support system did you have before this?
Before the fire?
Mm-hmm.
I had wonderful friends who were always there for me and up and down, and a wonderful girlfriend who means the world to me. And they were there right through it.
And that helped, I trust?
It is has been my my foundation for getting through these these few months so far, and I know will be for the future.
So what's your vision for the future? How's that look to you?
Well, it's looking better, you know, as time progresses. You know, I'm still currently working at my new job that I accepted, and I love it very much. And, you know, my friends have all been there and are always there when I need them to talk or discuss something or, you know, let some feelings out. But, you know, the future is, you know, being able to look at this event and say, okay, it has changed me, but I wanted to change me for the better, being realizing that I was thankful for not going to worrying about losing material possessions to worrying about, like, or thinking about the memories that were associated with it, like focusing on, I still have those memories, you know, that I may not have the physical objects anymore, but I still have them in my heart and in my thoughts.
You just took a page out of Leslie Becker Phelps' playbook, because that's just what she's been talking about. Matthew, thanks so much for your call.
Thank you very much, Dan.
And I'm so sorry for what happened to you. Leslie,
yes.
Speaking of out of nowhere, what happened to you when you fell on your face last year?
What happened to me? I was last February, I was walking into my mother's house, and my foot caught the door jamb. And honestly, I don't remember where my hands were. I'm going to guess they were in my pockets, because the next thing I knew, my face was planted into the floor, and I knew it wasn't good. And it turned out that I had a tripod fracture in my face, which is basically three bones broken in my face. And so I was in the emergency room and 2 days in the hospital. An amazing plastic surgeon who was so wonderful. His bedside manner was great. I will forever thank Dr. Nagy for that. You know, it was tough. I had to walk myself through it. Unfortunately, I learned that morphine does not work for me. It was as bad as breaking my face. And unfortunately, I still have pain from it.
And did it change your identity?
You know, it did not change my identity, but it certainly reinforced that all... I certainly try to practice what I preach, and this was a wonderful opportunity to practice what I preach, so I had to stay focused in the moment. I was appreciative for the people who were there to help me. I used my meditation, my mindfulness, to keep me kind of grounded. I developed lockjaw, too, which, if you've ever had, is painful. Yeah. Or at least certainly when it set in, it was extremely painful. And so to be able to keep that focus, keep that calm, be calm for my kids. You know, stay focused, made sure, you know, while I was in the emergency room, making sure that, you know, my patients were taken care of, because there's a good chance I wasn't going to be able to see them.
Yeah, and you, so you had something to do. You were busy. And so you were focused on your life and not just on your pain, and that helps a great deal. I want to see if we can bring another caller in. We've got Robin on the line. Hi, Robin.
Hi, Dr. Dan. How are you?
Good. What can we do for you?
Well, I'm calling because I could very much relate to the subject today. I was married to, still I am married to, a beautiful 30-year-old man at the time, about 8 years ago, and 10 months into our newly married life. He was diagnosed with stage 4 brain cancer. And it fundamentally changed my constitution. It has changed the fabric of who I am. And I'm afraid it's defined me in a way that I don't care for. In the grieving process that your experts were speaking of, I feel as though I've sort of gotten stuck at the anger stage. And I'm having trouble moving forward. And my husband, miraculously, is still here and doing well, and he seems relatively emotionally unaffected by it.
It's amazing about him, and it's not unusual about you. Bea, do you have any thoughts for Robin?
Well, I guess I had more questions than thoughts. There's so much I would like to know and understand about what you've done in your life since that diagnosis, and more about who you were as a person before this challenged you, to understand better, you know, where your anger and what it means for you to move forward.
It seems to me, and I've dealt with many caregivers whose husbands specifically became disabled, and a lot of them are very, very angry. And you know, the issue is, you know, to move on, you have to let go. And we have lost so much control of our lives, like giving up what little control. So we hold on to this identity of what happened to us. You know, it's like wearing a threadbare coat in the winter. It doesn't keep you warm, but it's really all you've got. And the task is what we've been talking about the whole time, is self-compassion, is caring for oneself and not anything else, just self-compassion. Unfortunately, we are out of time. I've been talking about how life comes at us with Leslie Becker Phelps and Bea Hollander Goldfein. We also heard earlier from Aviva Perlow. Thanks to all of you so much for joining us today. And I want to close with these thoughts. Several years ago, a 28-year-old woman came to see me. She was a beautiful and vibrant, a promising young lawyer with lots of friends and a wonderful social life. One day, her legs felt weak and she had difficulty walking. 2 weeks later, she was in the hospital being diagnosed with a spinal tumor. Several days later, she was a paraplegic. She came to see me because she knew that I knew. I was thinking about her last night when I took my cousin Arlene out to dinner. She was married to my cousin Donald, who passed away several months ago. His death had taken place about 2 weeks before our dinner. Understandably, Arlene was devastated and kept repeating, "I don't know how I can go on." I remember thinking that she was asking precisely the right question. See, the question itself carries the answer. We can go on. And with very few exceptions, we do go on. We just don't know how yet. That answer, like most answers, can only come when we look through the rearview mirror of our lives. Much more commonplace is the story of most of us who've been divorced. It's as though we're walking down the street and all of a sudden there's no ground under us and we find ourselves in free fall. Suddenly, our lives bear no resemblance to the lives we had previously or the lives we were expecting. How do we look into the future when all we can feel is fear, confusion, grief, often anger? I told Arlene about my accident when I questioned whether I could go on. I felt the same way when my wife left 10 years later. And here I am, 33 years after the accident. And when I look in the rearview mirror to answer the question, how did I go on? I still don't have any clear answers, just grand theories. Next week on Voices, we'll be preempted by special programming in honor of Martin Luther King Jr. We'll be back on the 28th to talk about how our identities and what's important to us really changes as the years go by. Well, please comment on today's show. We're at whyy.org/voices, and you can download the show there or on iTunes. You can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Fred Snyder. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Emily Haas is our production assistant. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is our producer. And, oh yeah, I'm Dan Gottlieb, the host. Enjoy your week, my friends.